Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 93.
93.
That's Portuguese in a really bad rolling of my R.
It's the first night of Hanukkah. We don't have any songs.
You do spin the dreidel, light the lights.
Oh, I guess that's true.
That was like a choir song in high school that we did for our Christmas and Happy Hanukkah concert.
Happy holidays, everybody listening. It's great to have you back with us for the holiday season of podcasts. You know what?
Apparently, David Diggs, for those theater fans, he was Lafayette in the original cast of Hamilton. He played like two, and he played
Jefferson.
My God. Yes, Jefferson. In Act Two, but he, I guess, released a Hanukkah song, so we'll have to listen to that today.
Yeah, I got to get those, you know, tunes on as we light our menorah here in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
But we got some interesting circus updates for you, starting with our own circus updates. Lindsay and I put out a casting call last week now for circus performers for an upcoming show that we're doing next year in 2021. It's going to be an outdoor circus show that we tour around the Northeast region of America for probably around 8 weeks. All of the information on how to apply and what we've said publicly about it is on our website, hideawaycircus.com. And it's pretty amazing, I would say, how many applicants we've gotten so far and the quality of people.
I mean, it's amazing watching all these people's videos because you're like, oh my God, they're so good. Oh no, this person is also so good. And this person is also so good. And usually it's Josh watching all the videos because I honestly have such a hard time letting go, like saying, okay, this person isn't right. It happens with every casting we do. I come in at the end because I could find one good thing about everyone. And that's not what makes a good casting person.
Well, casting is not easy, and it's really complicated now given the pandemic because we can't go and see people live. We can't go and see shows. We can't have in-person meetings. Everything has to be done on the internet. And one thing I've spoken to a couple of our colleagues about is after the Black Lives Matter movement this summer, it just became evident that hiring people who you know and doing that as like your go-to move, hire the people you've worked with before, prevents new people from coming in. And that's one of the main barriers to finding new people, hiring new people, accessibility in our industry. So the idea behind the open casting call is that anybody can apply. Obviously, we have to figure out ways to get it out to people, promoting it on the podcast, on Circus Talk's website, on Facebook and Instagram. But the idea is that we're just trying to find out who's out there. And there's a lot of people out there. And of course, we have a preference for Americans because I have no idea what the travel circumstances will be by this summer. Right.
Plus getting a visa. I mean, we were literally in the process of being done with a visa for our dancer. And then COVID hit and he had to go home and it's not actually finished. So, I mean, just the whole idea of even trying to get a visa for someone.
But there's a lot of great American circus artists. And I know some of you might be our friends and or friends know us, have worked with us, met us in some capacity and are wondering like, should I apply? You know who I am. You've seen my act in person. Please do apply on our website if you do want to work with us and be part of the show next year, even if we've hung out and maybe you've been a past podcast guest. I don't know. But it's really the easiest way for us to keep track of everything is through this one document, essentially, that has everybody's names, their acts, their bios. And there's nothing weird, as far as I'm concerned, about applying if you know us, even if you feel like, well, Josh has seen my act dozens of times. Like, I don't need to submit it. It's just helpful for us to have everything in one place.
I know that you're interested.
And that you're interested. Yeah. You know, we do want people to some degree to come to us and say like, yeah, that's something I'm excited to do so that when we get everybody together, we're kind of all on the same page. Not so interesting for me, at least on this project, try to convince people to participate in it because it's going to be its own challenge. You know, it's going to be an outdoor show. We're going to have to figure out how to navigate this post-pandemic world. We really want to create, as we did with Babel, like a really special cast of people who work really well together and act like a family or a team. And it's just easier to do that when people come to you and say, I want to be part of it, rather than trying to get somebody to understand the vision and do it that way. So I don't think Lindsay and I will probably make any final casting decisions before the end of January. So it's about another month or so to apply online and send us your stuff. It's going to be a tough process to pick people. I mean, honestly, out of the 200 people I think we've gotten so far, there's maybe two people who we saw immediately who were like, oh my God, we have to have them. This is amazing. And then another dozen, two dozen people who were like, wow, they are great. Shortlist. Like, let's see who else comes in. But these are really great options. So get your name on there. Visit our website, hideawaycircus.com. All of the casting information is right there on the front page. If you're more of a Circus Talk person, Circus Talk's a great online network and platform for finding circus jobs and news. We're on there as well. You can find the information through our Circus Talk page, their job page. We really hope you apply and join us in trying to make something really cool for next year.
You know what that reminds me of is last night there was this Best of Broadway Live on NBC, and it was basically like a fundraiser, Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, that crew that does the red buckets every year when you leave the theater, collecting money for AIDS research. But they were doing it for a fundraiser for actors and all of the people who work in theater to help them, you know, pay for healthcare or like literally their food bill or house bill or whatever. But they were like, one person was saying how like resilient you have to be an actor, because you have no's all your life and then you get that like one yes. And it is so true, because at least in circus, you have tangible skills. In theater, it's like, I don't really like their voice. You know, it's so much more subjective. But it was fun to watch last night.
You know, I saw people on Twitter who were talking about this like NBC Broadway show that you watched, Sing Along, I guess it was called.
It was, yeah.
Saying, you know, we have so many people watching that. It was a real shame that nobody took a moment to promote the Save Our Stages Act or any actual like.
No, it was silly.
Any methods to help the industry recover. It was right. Just.
I know. Well, it was frustrating, honestly, watching, because it was like, A, I had no idea this was a fundraiser, right? Going into it. Then it was like, oh, it's a fundraiser. And then it was like, for who? For what? How are people getting this money? You know, like, it was just like, donate online. And the whole thing was strange. And it was like, not even talking about like how all these shows could never come back and theaters could never come. I mean, it's just like, it was kind of weird. And there was Jersey Boys, two numbers from Jersey Boys, which has been closed for a long time. And it was whatever it was.
Speaking of shows that may or may never be coming back, Cirque du Soleil announced that they're going to be working on getting their Vegas shows back up, and they've gone through bankruptcy. I think one of the interesting things to me about this whole journey is who's really leading the company coming out of this bankruptcy proceeding. They still have $300 million of debt. So if you remember before, if you listen to our past podcasts, Cirque was previously overleveraged and had $1.3 billion of debt. All their previous private equity owners were wiped away. Their new ownership are their previous creditors. And they now have a new chair of the board. They have two co-chairs. One's a guy who runs a private equity group called Capitalist. But another guy is this gentleman named Jim Murren, who to me is really the most interesting piece of the future Cirque puzzle. So Jim Murren was previously the CEO of MGM Resorts for the last 20 years. He stepped down in February and has since been leading the Nevada COVID task force. And he's a real Las Vegas casino insider. And he's going to be probably the most powerful person, he's one of the most powerful people at the company. So to me, this really indicates a focus on Las Vegas and a focus on indoor shows at casinos, whether that be MGM casinos in the US or MGM casinos abroad. But that to me seems like somewhere where we're going to see action before we see tours or before we see
for sure
some of the other kinds of things Cirque du Soleil worked on. And you know, we've talked before many times about the different kinds of unusual and typical like business practices that we see Cirque du Soleil do. One thing I thought that was interesting about Jim Murren is that he currently has a SPAC, which people who listen to like business podcasts might know what a SPAC is, but another word for it is a blank check company. But basically, back this fall, I believe, maybe in October, he raised $200 million with a few other business partners, and their goal with that $200 million is to find a company to buy, either in the live entertainment space or the gaming space or the resort and hospitality space, and make it, turn it into a public company with not really with an IPO, but essentially like having an IPO. So why am I saying this? It's interesting because it's what companies in live entertainment would Jim Murren, while he's also on the board of Cirque, pick up. And then of course Cirque has these other companies within it, V-Star, the Works, that's their magic company, or that does 1903 and The Illusionists. They have Blue Man Group. They have a lot of things. So if those things get spun off and go to, you know, this blank check company, or if he decides to buy competitors, it's all very interesting. And the power plays and the dynamics that we're going to see in the next 6 months will really, I think, give us a clear indication of the plans for the company and where it's going to head.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we were talking to people before COVID, and honestly before Cirque had a lot of public problems, everyone who we would talk to who knew anything about Cirque du Soleil knew a bit that they were in financial problems, and then was like, everyone I talked to should just tells them to shut their tours and focus on Vegas. That's where they make their most money, and franchise those casino shows to other places in the world that have casinos and have theaters to fill shows. Not thinking artistically at all, and not thinking about, you know, wanting to create circus shows. Yeah, that makes total sense. And that makes sense even more now with like a financial crisis and every single thing is shut down. Like, what an opportunity for them to just say, oh, because of COVID, we're shutting all these tours. We just can't reopen. We're focusing on Vegas. It's almost like the perfect storm again for Cirque in a way, because they were, you know, they were going to lose so much money on Paramore when they opened on Broadway. So much money. And then Harry Potter wanted to come and take their theater and bought them out. So they didn't actually lose that much money. I mean, it's funny how Cirque kind of can spin these moments of like crises in their company, and it works out for them.
Well, works out is still, I'd say TBD. Nothing has reopened yet. The things that have been announced as reopening, as we talked about, aren't really their shows. They're shows that are franchised to other people. So I think we'll start to see shows come back in Vegas this year. Which ones? We guessed last time. So listen to our last podcast to guess about it. But keep an eye on this guy, Jim Murren. I think he's going to be the real indicator as to the way in which the company will lean and what direction it will go in. And he's an ally of Daniel Lamar. They've clearly known one another for a long time, given their overlap in Vegas. We predicted the ouster of Lamar. It hasn't happened yet, but I have a feeling that we're going to start to see some new players emerge. Mm-hmm. Who they'll be, I'm not totally sure, but
yeah, I mean, I'm happy they're coming back. It would be such a loss to so many jobs, you know, if they never came back. So I'm happy. Plus, then I can go make sure I try to see O. I haven't never seen O, which is insane. Also, I was thinking about their board, and I think it's pretty much all white guys and one girl.
Yeah. So, I mean, their board right now, this is the current board, has, you know, Jim Murren, who just talked about, then Gabriel De Alba. He's the other co-chairman who runs Catalyst Group, the private equity company that managed the bankruptcy and the new takeover and new bids. And then they have people from RB Partners, which is a financial firm, Soundpoint Capital, it's an investment firm, another MGM person. Of course, Daniel Lamar is also on the board. This woman, Annie Martini, who I think is who you were referencing, who works at a company called CH Group. And then two more people who are from Qualia Legacy Advisors and Eldridge Business. So it sounds like mostly a board of business people, with a few people who know the inner workings of MGM as a resource company. Speaking of shows that, you know, aren't back or coming back, there are shows that are happening, circus shows in America happening right now that are still up and going. We've talked about some of the shows in Las Vegas with Absinthe, but we've seen now shows happening in Texas and in Florida.
Yes, Universal is doing their show in Texas. They're doing it with no size on the tent, so it'll be safer and socially distanced. They're doing every other row. I mean, it's a huge tent, and they're doing a 500 seat capacity, I think. They did a morning news thing, which literally brings me back to a horrendous feeling of doing morning news in San Diego. And in New York, morning news just sucks. There's never been a good morning news, really good morning news experience. I mean, the New York morning news in New York.
With Pix 11.
With Pix 11 was much better than anything in San Diego, which was just hilarious and always not well run. But anyway, Universal did a morning news clip that I watched, and they had their ringmaster talking to the newswoman. And their tent is huge, so it's a great opportunity for them to go down to 500 seats and without the sides. I mean, it definitely takes away any ability to create theatrical lighting and interesting lighting because it's just, you know, super bright. And because it's also still has the top part of the tent, it's like this, it feels almost like a wedding tent. You know what I mean? Like it's almost like when you see photos of Midnight Circus in Chicago doing their outdoor show completely outdoors with no tent at all. It almost has a better feeling than having a half tent up. But I haven't seen the show, obviously, so it might be different being there versus seeing it on video. But at the morning news, they had like a hand-to-hand act going on. And they were like, and these, I forget their act name, you know, guys are from Africa. And, you know, this next trick, don't try it at home unless you've seen a dentist. And it's like, the camera guy clearly didn't know what was going on because he kept like missing like what was happening, but it's a cool trick, but you can't see it from every angle. So like the guy put a strap around the flyer's stomach and then picked him up with his teeth. Like he had like a mouthpiece on the back of the strap, so then he picks him up and like is holding him by his teeth while like the guy is doing like Jesus pose in front, if that makes sense. Does it make sense?
I mean, I've seen the video, so I know what you mean, but yeah.
Does that make sense how I described it? I think so.
People have to write in and tell us if they can visualize that or not.
I don't know, but the camera guy should have been from the side so you could see that he was like holding on with his teeth. I don't know.
So pro tip, if you're a producer or director and you're doing the morning news, set your expectations low.
Really low. Like, although the worst morning news was definitely in Australia.
Yeah, we talked about that one, I think, if you go back in some of our Aussie episodes. Also shows that are happening at the moment this December. Our guest, Pedro Reis, who runs the Circus Arts Conservatory in Sarasota, Florida, they're doing shows this December and February, both in person and online. And he talks about it a little bit at the end of the podcast. You can get your tickets at circusarts.org. But also quite interesting to hear the differences between Florida and Texas and Vegas in what the approaches are, what the limits on space is. Everywhere seems to have slightly different regulations, but Florida seeming to be pretty flexible.
Yeah, but they still are doing socially distanced, wearing masks. The thing with Florida that I think makes it a little hard is that the government isn't really mandating anything, and it's almost business by business. And then you have people who live in Florida who don't want to follow those rules. And because they're different, depending on whatever business you're at. I was talking to a friend who lives down there, and going to a salon, like you have to call the salon and ask what their protocols are. Because, you know, in New York, it's like every salon has to follow these guidelines, and you know, and you have to wear a mask and all this stuff. Versus in Florida, some salons don't have mask mandates at all, or, you know, and it's about just like what you're comfortable with. So, but they do seem like they're doing a, you know, a show that's socially distanced, wear your mask and have like air purifiers and all this stuff. So it seems like if I were in Florida, I would go see the show.
For sure. And this episode is awesome. I'm so excited for you guys to hear it. Pedro is like the real deal, as I said at the end of it, real circus legend. He's done multiple different kinds of flying acts over the course of his career with loads of companies in Europe. He toured, of course, with Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey in the U.S. His wife is Dolly Jacobs, who is an equally famous, if not more famous, aerialist and circus star. And he now lives in Sarasota, Florida, and runs the Circus Arts Conservatory, as well as Sailor Circus. One's a youth performing program. He explains the differences of the various programs that they have, but it's a similar combination of shows, education, and social outreach. And it's really just, it's so awesome to hear somebody with such a level of traditional knowledge and actual hands-on experience. It reminded me a lot of our episode with Salam Awabi, of just hearing people who've really grown up in this world, the circus world, and been educated and seen life through it in such a way that there is no faking it. And it comes across from, honestly, the very first sentence. And fair warning for our listeners, this is like a deep cut. So we talk a lot about different circuses, people who run circuses, performers, and we don't take too much time to pause and explain who different people are and their connections. So if you're a real circus fan, you should really enjoy it. If you're a new person to the podcast and this is your first one, this is a little more challenging than the average episode as far as to understand everything we're talking about. But still, I think Pedro's personality comes through really well, and I really, really enjoyed it.
Yes. Well, Pedro does. Well, he has a few acts, but one of his acts is a cradle act. And I thought I knew what that was. And then as he was explaining it, I was like, oh my God, maybe I don't know what this is. And he explains it because I asked him to, and he says, YouTube it. I do think you should YouTube it because I did know what it was once I saw it. But his acts are really interesting. And if you understand what it actually looks like and is, it's much easier to follow the stories about his acts. So I'd look up cradle act. I'd look up a cloud swing if you don't know what that is.
Or even Google Pedro Reis, R-E-I-S, on YouTube, and you should be able to find a lot of his classic numbers.
Yeah, I think that's a good – and Josh will link them in the bio. But also in the show notes. But also, this was a little hard for me to even follow because I was like, oh, I think I know who that one is. But it's awesome hearing his story, so it doesn't really matter if you know or don't know. And I love how much of a strong opinion he has about terms that we throw around in America specifically. You know, he has a reaction to one of Josh's terms, which was hilarious and also really valid. And I totally get it. And yeah, I just love talking to people who have really strong opinions about things. And because then you can really have a full-on conversation. This was a very fun episode. So, if you like our podcast, please make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Instagram, on Facebook, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Here is our episode with Pedro Reis.
Pedro, where are we reaching you at the moment?
I'm Cape. So I'm in Sarasota, Florida.
And that's where you live. That's where you live. You've been living for a while, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I came to America in 1984 to join Ringling, toured for 2 years. And then later on in 1987, came back and homesteaded in Sarasota.
But I think your accent gives away a little bit that you're not American. So you just said it. But so you're from South Africa. Where in South Africa did you grow up?
Cape Town. That's where I actually started my circus training at the local YMCA.
Did you see circuses like traveling through Cape Town as a kid?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I remember going to my first circus still today. It was actually as a school trip, and a midget actually came to the school and started handing out these discount vouchers. And then the class got together and got a bus and went to go see the circus. And it was Boswell and Wilkie Circus.
Is that a South African company?
Yeah, it's a South African company. The owner was Mr. Wilkie. It was from England. And I can still remember the smell, you know, coming to the circus, hearing the generator. I remember the stairs going up into the tent and then like just seeing, looking down and seeing the ring and these vendors walking through the tent. And it was just like just this magic. And and I could hear the lions roaring in the back. It was like, wow, this is cool. Yeah. I must have been about 8.
Is seeing that show what inspired you to pursue circus? What got you into learning about it and training originally?
Yeah, the story goes, you know, it's kind of a serendipity thing. I'll start with when my parents moved one suburb to another. The suburb we moved to was called Observatory, and it was a local YMCA. So when I woke up the next day, we moved in the evening, actually. I walked out my front door, and across the street was this flying trapeze rigging and a trampoline. So I thought, wow, this looks very, very interesting, you know. And funny enough, I don't know if it was 6 months prior to that or a year, there was a fair in the town that we lived in previously. And I went to the fair, and there was this flying trapeze group. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. I'd really like to try that one day. And it was the same people. we moved, and I just got to know the same people that I just see. It was, like I say, a serendipity thing. But in the beginning, I used to get into lots of trouble because I just sneak in through the fence at night and jump on a trampoline or play in the net. And the YMCA warden used to chase me around the trampoline and eventually chased me home, told my dad I got a good spanking every now and again, went back again. And then I befriended the guys that were actually training on the flying trapeze to become professional flying trapeze artists. And I'd be like the errand boy, right? I'd like go buy the cigarettes or get them Cokes, keep the change, of course. And then one day I said, you know, can I go? I was watching for a long time. And then one day I said, can I go up and swing? And I said, sure. That was it. I was hooked. You know, just took one swing and it was like, this is what I want to do. And that was it.
My gosh, how old were you at this point?
I must have been about 11. Yeah, wow. I can't really remember. It must have been between, I'd say 10 or 11, yeah.
Were your parents supportive of you pursuing circus to this degree?
So in South Africa at that time, I mean, we didn't have TV, right? So everybody was outdoors. All kids played outdoors. So, yeah, they were just like glad that I was going somewhere. You know, I had a good group of friends. And after school, I'd just put my books down, run across the street to the YMCA, go on a trapeze, on a trampoline. And you know, when the sun went down, I'd come home, you know, that was it. And then slowly but surely, what happened is I started inviting some of my friends from high school. Then later on in high school, I said to my friends, hey, you want to come down? We're looking for catchers. We're looking for, you know. And so we took the flying trapeze school and built it into a circus school for youth. That's the kind of the evolution of the trapeze school.
And when you say we built it, what role were you playing in that? Because presumably you're still like quite a young man at the time.
Yeah, so the original founder was Keith Anderson. You know, you have to give him credit for starting it all. And then, I mean, I came in as the junior leader. And I have this ability to lead. And I was very serious about the training. And I just took to it. And like I say, we built it from a flying trapeze school to a full-blown circus school. And then this gentleman by the name of George Chamberti, who actually became my mentor. He's from Algiers originally, and he started his circus career with a very famous circus family in Europe, the Fratellinis. And he was, he could tumble. A lot of the Moroccans, Algerians, they tumble on the beaches those days, way back, still do, I suppose, now. Anyway, he was scooped up by the Fratellini. He got to learn a mini trapeze rigging, and was booked to come to Ringling just, I believe it was either, I think just after the Second World War. He came to America, and he homesteaded here as well. And his wife was the sister of somebody, of Mrs. Wilkie, right? So the story goes, once a year, George would bring over Spanish webs and swivels to South Africa, to the circus, and he would stay there. So I got to meet the people, the folks at Boswell and Wilkie Circus, and I got to meet George. And so we invited George to actually stay in Cape Town and become one of our professional coaches and trainers. And so through him, I really got to learn the way it should be done and not just do it. You know, just do it. So yeah, so he was my mentor.
So from like high school, I'm confused by the timeline. So did you just start basically running the school from when you were little till?
No, I didn't run the school by myself at all. Keith Anderson was the person who actually was in charge of everything. Started everything, was in charge, right? And then I became like his deputy, if you want to call it, like the next guy down. And so I was already in middle school, though, when I started, you know, because I was, like I say, I must have been like 11 years old, something like that. And then through high school, and here's another story that I don't really tell everybody, but in my, what's it, in South Africa, would have been standard 10 over here, it'd be 12th grade, your last year of school. So, man, I was so frustrated. I was just, I don't want to do this. So 3 months into my 12th grade, I just got up out of the class. I took my books, went down to the principal's office and said, I don't need these books anymore. I'm joining the circus. Done. And of course, there was this dead silence. And he stuttered and he's like, what? What? What are you going to do? I said, I'm going to join the circus. Thank you very much. And out the door I went. Of course, my mother freaked out. The warden at the YMCA freaked out. Everybody freaked out, you know. And I said, no, this is what I'm going to do. So we decided to put a troop together. It was a troop of 13 of young people. And only two of the 13 had any circus experience. We did seven acts at that time. We did a flying trapeze act with three catchers. So we had triple lane flying trapeze act. We had a seven-person high wire act. We had a double trampoline with a pedestal and catcher. We had a comedy acrobatic vaulting mini tramp act. We had, so yeah, so we did a bunch, we had a bicycle act with dinghy cycles. We had a Russian bar act. And so, yeah, we left and took, you know, Europe by storm. All these greenhorns knew nothing about it, but it was a great adventure. It was really a great adventure. So, yeah, so that was the beginning.
How did you get sort of hired by that first professional circus? I think a lot of people these days think about, I got to make a video. I got to go to circus school. I got to do all these certain things to be discovered. How did it happen for you?
Yes. So Keith Anderson, again, knew a lot of people in Europe, you know, because he used to produce flying trapeze acts and then send them out to Europe to, you know, for profession. And there's one agent in England with Don Stacey. They had been talking and they actually got a contract at a Tivoli in Denmark. That was our first stop. Aarhus and Odense was our first two stops, our first, entrance into the professional world of circus. And it was, we were young and we were all Superman, you know, so we could do all these acts and enjoy it. And we were getting a measly stipend because we were paying back all the debt, right? We were paying back all the rigging that we had to get built, all the airfares we had to. It was tough. It was really rough and tough, but it was enjoyable and it was adventurous. And so we went from Denmark to England and we went to Jerry Cottle Circus, which was our first tenting show because Denmark was at Tivoli. It was outdoors. And at Jerry's show, we got to learn the ropes, right, of how to put a tent up. He asked me for help, and I got my guys, and we started working on the tent, putting the tent up, putting a rigging up. And from there, we went to Paris, and we worked in Port-au-Versailles, which was Bouglion. And we also then got a chance to work in Cirque de Verre, the building, the famous circus building. And it was that was truly awesome. The old man, Joseph Bouglion, was still alive at that time. If you remember the movie Trapeze, he walked around with the big cowboy hat and the chimpanzee on his shoulder. And that was a true picture because he still had the chimpanzee. It was amazing. So, and then from there, we went to, I believe it was back to England. And then we went up to Norway. And from Norway, Circus Barony, down all the way down to Sicily. We drove for 6 days and we joined Circo Emerald River. And it was a huge Italian circus. Touring Sicily was very interesting. And we had the opportunity then to actually go to Monte Carlo. And we weren't competing in Monte Carlo, but we were the Charivari. So we did pyramids and acrobatics. And when they were putting up the flying trapeze net, I would go up. I actually swung and did comedy flying on the trapeze without a net and stuff like that, you know. So from there, we went to Holland, and I think it was Circus Holiday. And that was a 4-year run, basically, right? And so the young people that we were with, some of them wanted to leave, go back to South Africa, etc. So actually, it was the third year, I beg your pardon. And then so we made a deal. We all shook hands and said, okay, let's go back to South Africa. We'll do a tour on Boswell and Wolke Circus, and then we'll shake hands and split our own ways. And that's what we did. Went back to South Africa. We did a tour. We shook hands. And during that time, I was like scratching my head thinking, what the hell am I going to do now? So, and again, another chance situation. A friend of mine showed me this video of the Palacis. And the Palacis was the husband and wife duo that were working also in Cirque du Vert. And they were doing, so we call it a cradle act. Some people call it a casting act, right? where the catch is hanging by his legs, basically, right? The pedestal. And then you would just jump into the air, right? He would catch you and you would do front somersault, pirouettes, whatever. But they used a net. And then I found out there was the original guys were called the Palacis. I always get mixed up. Anyway, there was actually did everything without a net. Two people got killed. And I know a friend of mine knew them from South Africa. They actually toured in Bosman-Wilke circus. Long story short, I spoke to my catcher on the Flying Trapeze, my ex, and we decided we were going to put this act together. And we called it the Survivors, right? It was an appropriate name. So it was, you know, walk 40 feet in the air, leaping into the air, doing pirouettes, somersaults, clips. And of course, you know, don't fall was the rule. Just don't fall.
Oh my God.
And we did Flying Trapeze as well. So we did a couple of acts. And our first stop was after South Africa was Switzerland. And while in Switzerland, Kenneth and his father, Irvin Felt, were scouting. And they got a message from Circus Knie. So they go see those South Africans on Circus Knock, because I was with Circus Knock. And of course, it was our dream to go to America and join the greatest show on earth, right? And not only that, though, but my mentor, George and Bertie, lived in Sarasota. So at that time, you remember the postcard? We still wrote postcards back then. I don't know, you're too young to remember, but we actually wrote postcards.
No, I'm not too young. Maybe Josh, but I did write postcards.
It was so great. I got the opportunity, wrote him a postcard. Hey, we're coming to him. We signed a contract with the Ringling, obviously. And we were just signed for the Survivors. We gave up the Flying Trapeze. I sold the rigging. And so end of 83, we left and went to America and was awesome 2 years, you know, touring the United States on a train. In Bosman-Wilke circus, we traveled on a train as well. So I was kind of used to it. And in Ringling, obviously, we were on the train as well. And we toured with a blue unit. And so the red unit and the blue unit crisscrossed America. So I got to work and see 48 states of the United States. So, you know, again, I always tell people that the circus was a great and is a great education, right? Culturally and geographically, you learn so much because you travel and you see things and you learn things. So it's amazing, you know. So after with the Survivor Act again, I mean, there's a lot of nerves involved because there's no net, you know. And my catcher actually, after 4 years, started getting real nervous and to the point where he said, I can't do this anymore. Another funny story is when we came to Sarasota, the performance director's wife, Araceli, father, was the last person to do that type of act in America in 1952. And so we got together, you know, and we started looking at photo albums. And it was really weird because we were both in the same positions, you know, in the pirouette and the somersaults. And the same thing happened to him with his catcher. They were in Madison Square Gardens, and he was about to do the front somersault, and his catcher froze. Didn't let him go. And they climbed down, and that was the end of the act. That was 1952. So we were the next. 1984 was the reintroduction of that type of act. But like I say, after 4 years, my catcher decided he wanted to quit. So we decided we were going to go to Europe. We went to, we played Carré in Amsterdam. We went to Monte Carlo. We did Monte Carlo with the act. And then we went to a Circus Krone in Germany. And that was the last stop. And we did a month there. And it was sad though, because Knie came to us and said, hey, my father, it was Freddie, actually it was Franco. Franco said, my father would like to hire you guys to join the circus. And so it's like a weird thing, but it was, you know, you've kind of reached the pinnacle when you say no thank you to the best circus in the world, basically, right? And then, of course, I scratched my head some more and thought, okay, so what am I going to do now? So we decided we were going to put a troupe together and go back to Ringling. We went to double trampoline and flying trapeze, two sets of flying trapeze acts. So we met up in Cape Town, the old group, which was called the Star-Lords, by the way, because Star-Lords was hot at that time. And so we're back to Cape Town, and we started training in this, what was it? It was a old electrical warehouse. I swear there was asbestos area, I'm sure of it. But anyway, it was the only place we could find to train. And that's when I decided to put together my solo Cloudswing act. And I didn't really want to just do a Cloudswing act. I wanted to do something with a special finish, right? My first thought was, okay, let go the Cloudswing standing, fly, do a front somersault through a huge burning hoop and catch a rope. Okay, so I tried to actually do a front somersault off the Cloudswing, and it was too unpredictable because you're not pushing off anything because it's a rope. So I thought, okay, what's the next best thing? All right, let's see. What if I jump and catch a rope, but it's suspended, it's pulled up on a piece of string, and I drop 30, 35 feet, and there's a piece of bungee on the other end, and it slows me down. I touch the floor and let go of the rope. All right, so yeah, that sounds like a great idea. All right, let's see. How far should I imagine? Well, if I let go, I should go about that far. Okay. On Ringling, a Bulgarian guy, Atli, actually taught me how to make my own Cloudswing, how to cover it, how to sew the leather and everything. It was great. It was wonderful. So I made my own Cloudswing. It was 35 feet long. It was really a long swing. And then I put the rope up, which was actually ended up being 26 feet further. And so I would jump and catch a rope, which was pulled up and tied off with a piece of string. And then I had a 10-foot military-grade bungee. So I would be catch the rope, string would break, and I'd be on the floor in 2 seconds, basically, or 1.5 seconds, touch the floor, let go of the rope, and voila. And then literally land in front of the audience. The eyes were like saucers, and I'd shake their hand, you know? So
amazing. There's a lot in there. We gotta ask you some questions about that journey before we get.
Wait, first thing, I need you to.
I get carried away. Sorry.
No, it's amazing.
It's wonderful.
There's so much, but so okay. I think I get what the cradle act is, but maybe I don't. So I obviously know what a static trapeze looks like, and a swinging trapeze, and flying trapeze.
YouTube.
So the cradle.
YouTube it. YouTube. Cradle. Look up the survivors.
But can you try to explain it just so people listening?
Okay, sure.
Can also imagine.
So it's a metal frame. Wow, how do you describe metal? It's
a oval, hard one, actually.
Oval okay. Metal frame, which we are standing up, suspended, right, with two hanging points. Mm-hmm. And then the catcher hangs by his knees, and his feet are locked into the other bar, and he pushes off his legs and is suspended out horizontal, and you are facing him, and you actually jump out and do a half turn or a back somersault, a back flip, and he comes in and catches you, and he is the pendulum, and the two of you become the pendulum.
It's like cradle, like Russian cradle on the ground, but you guys were doing it in the air.
So right?
It's the normal kind of cradle.
Yeah.
So when people do it on the ground, I've seen that.
You mean when it's like two poles and you're standing and you're doing it between your legs and
so that's
hammer?
That's called casting. That's when they're throwing people. They're standing up, right?
Yeah.
They're standing on two poles, like you said, with your feet. This is you hanging.
Okay.
Catches
okay.
upside
and it,
down.
And it's static, the thing
okay.
you're hanging from.
And you're right. high in the air with no net.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So, sounds very terrifying.
Well, yes. If you want to learn more, Google the survivors. One thing I wanted to sort of just pull out a little bit more was the number of companies you named, particularly on that first tour. You have like the beautiful circus buildings that exist in like Scandinavia and Paris. You dropped some like mud shows, like really the whole gamut.
No, don't say mud show. Don't say mud show.
Well, I have nothing against a mud show, or you know, I have no net.
To me, I just don't want any negative connotation associated with the circus. My whole mission in life was to raise the perception of the circus to be recognized as the art form. So anybody who says anything negative, I'm going to say, don't say it anymore. You know.
So yes. Okay. Well, then what term do you think, replaces that for the show that, you know, jumps every day and sets up?
It's very easy. It's called a tent show.
But you wouldn't necessarily put like the Cirque du Soleil level size tent or, you know, Ringling's Kaleidoscope on the same spectrum as.
Absolutely.
You know, Kelly, you would use the same label.
Okay.
To describe it.
European circus, American circus. You never say mud show in Europe ever, ever. Right? So when I came to America, they called me a performer. I said, a monkey can perform. I'm an artist. Right? So those are little things. Mm-hmm. It's the little things. Oh, it's a mud show. I almost punched the guy. Said, don't talk bad about the circus world, you know? So, but I know it's American connotation and those words stick. It infuriates me when they talk about Washington being like a circus, right? It totally infuriates me. If you open up the American dictionary, if you look up the word circus, it's attached to chaos. And they have no clue how organized the circus world is, right?
That's what I always think. I'm like, comparing it to a circus is unfair because I've never been a part of a thing that has to run so smoothly for everything to be safe, to work, for the audience to come in, to watch a show, to leave. I mean, it's like...
Exactly.
So
you get my drift about it.
I love these kinds of, you know, different ways of thinking about circus and how we talk about it.
So
I guess what I'm getting at is it's a wide spectrum of like venue that you really played leaving South Africa. You played little shows, you played buildings, you played festivals. And I'm wondering, you know, and also just pinging off of different things you said, you spoke about Algerian and Moroccan acrobats. And we actually interviewed one gentleman named Salam Awabi, who's now a coach up in Maine. But he was a Moroccan acrobat who did similar kinds of tours.
Sure.
But it seems like a pretty unrelenting lifestyle, essentially, you know, particularly sort of how we've heard about it. And I'm wondering if you can just sort of speak to, as somebody who's South African, what it was like experiencing all these different cultures. Like, had you traveled before this? Were you surprised by the different things you met? Like, seeing these shows for the first time? I'm just kind of curious about that immediate like exposure to all this new circus after being sort of in this one corner of the world.
Yeah. So, 16 millimeter movie reels, right? Projector. And we used to watch movies over and over and over and look at program books or whatever scrap of program books we could find. We would just look at everything and just take it all in. Right. So, no, I didn't travel a lot in South Africa. I went as far as Johannesburg, which was about 1,100 miles from Cape Town. And we did some fairs and stuff like that. So I didn't do much traveling at all before leaving South Africa. But it was an incredible cultural experience, right? Like I said before, it's a wonderful education. Meeting such a diverse group of people in so many different languages. I don't know if you're aware that if you grow up in the circus world, like in Europe, the child or the kid will end up speaking 6 to 8 languages fluently, right? It's amazing. And I'm very, very envious of that because I wasn't kid growing up. So my friends speak so many languages. I'm stuck with English and Afrikaans or Dutch, and I can speak German now. But, you know, It was a fantastic experience, is what I can say. But, you know, everything has a learning curve, and it was a huge learning curve. But like in anything that we do, we choose, let's say, what level we want to be at, right? So I was very serious about my career and where I wanted to go. So I basically shot for the moon, right? I wanted to do something different, unique, and be recognized for it.
You know, there's a lot of, I would say, in a lot of the way people talk about contemporary circus today, your act has to say something or be about something. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, in your mind, you know, the act creation, particularly having created so many different acts and theming them. You know, you mentioned a little bit the Star-Lord's number, the Survivor's number, and clearly there's themes in those names that are matching, you know, to some degree what the content of the performance is. And also just piggybacking a little bit of what you said of how saying words like mud show sort of remove the artistry, or saying performer removes the artist from the terminology. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about that, about the acts, how you made them in that little history you gave us, and just some of the thinking behind how they were created and what they were about or what they were showing.
Yeah, so it's a great question because I'm old school, or should I say I was trained old school. This is how you do it, right? And that was it. You learned how to do it. But also in a traditional circus, it's about what you do in the ring, meaning, okay, can you do 7 somersaults on the ground in a row, right? Stand one spot, do 7 somersaults, go 1, 2, 3, 4. Or can you do a bunkin act? And what you do and how you do it mesmerizes the people, because what they're seeing is impossible. How that is impossible. And so we were trained to produce the impossible. No theme, no, it has to speak to the people, because it's about energy, right? It's all energy. The people, the spectator buys a ticket, they sit in a seat, and now they want to be awed, they want to be wowed, they want to be mesmerized, they want to close their eyes because of the person way up in the top of the tent or building. And, you know, so when I put shows together, I call it a roller coaster of emotion and energy. So there's the modulation of energy, the aerialist, the beautiful juggler, the guy jumping on a horse, jumping off the horse. It's just a modulation of energies, right? Different energies. And so our shows are a combination of tradition and contemporary. So when contemporary started, was actually very fascinating and interesting, because so I'm in Sarasota, we have a lot of old timers. And for example, when Cirque du Soleil started, right, it was, that's not a circus. Oh, come on, that's not a circus. Okay, what is circus? To me, circus is a variety show. It really is a variety show. And the only difference between the traditional is that we have a ring. And to me, that ties back to the tradition of circus, because I always have a horse. To tie us back to the original reason why we have the ring is that the horse can gallop at a constant pace so that the jockey can stand on his back and do flips and stuff like that. So I pay homage to that tradition. But the show itself is a combination of everything. You know, so it's very fascinating for me where the circus has evolved to. And it really has evolved in many different directions. And I'm the kind of guy that, like I told you, I was taught that this is how you do it. And one day my brain said to me, you know what? There are no rules. There shouldn't be any rules, because we can all do things differently and amaze people differently. So as long as the people are amazed and we're doing some incredible stuff, it's okay. So Cirque du Soleil to me were like the first guys that really took it to a different place. But in Europe, there was a guy by the name of Bernard Paul, and he started Roncalli. Roncalli was a very small show, but it was a beautiful show where he combined fairy tales and theatrical lighting and took away the ta-da. There was no ta-da. There was no floodlights with different gel colors on it. You know, the lights didn't come on and go off. There was, you know, it was, they had spots, they had floods, they had, it was beautiful. You went there and you were mesmerized by the show. And so he was, I think, the innovator. And later on you had Grouse. Well, actually before that you had Grouse in Paris, which was a very small show, but very equestrian oriented by the Grouse family. And then of course in America, the Big Apple Circus, right, was based off Roncalli. Fratellini small circus. So contemporary, traditional, I think it's not one or the other. It can be, as long as it's amazing and it has the quality. Because when Dolly and I started the Circus Arts Conservatory, it was, again, I'll repeat it, but raising the perception of the circus to be recognized as the true art form that it is. And the only way you can do that is to present the highest quality to the public.
Were there other countries while you were touring where you felt like circus was seen at the appropriate, you know, level by the public from an artistic point of view? Or do you feel like there's nowhere really that totally gets it anymore?
No. In Holland, in Carré, for example, I mean, people put on their best suit. Ladies came out with their furs, right, to come see the show. And every single show was sold out. Every single show was sold out. Same thing in Germany, in Stuttgart. We went to a Christmas circus. Same thing, people dressed up. It was a huge tent that seated about 3,000 people. Every show was sold out. It's totally amazing. Yes, of course, as in anything in life, you're going to get the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? I mean, that's just reality. But Circus Knie, I mean, it's amazing. It's a beautiful show. It's a fantastic show. The acts that they hire, the animal acts they present are phenomenal. So, yeah, no, there's a hierarchy of like in everything in life. So,
I think Knie had one of the best horse acts that's stuck in my mind ever. I loved their horse acts with the little mini ponies and all the, I mean, it was amazing. I loved Knie. I totally agree. And I come from theater and started my journey in the circus world about 7 years ago when I met Josh, and was like amazed by the fact that there weren't, I felt like no rules, because in theater, it's very defined. Everything is very defined. And the conversation of circus being a true art form. I mean, I worked in fundraising for nonprofit theaters where it's very easy to apply for grants and, you know, you're defined as this nonprofit. This is what you do. These are the programs you run. And then hearing the conversation through the circus world of how do we get funding? Like, how do we become these, you know, art form that is taken very seriously is so interesting for me to go on this journey, because I'm an American. I grew up going to circus, but I have like a very specific image of it. And then not until I was introduced to circus as a full worldview or trying to understand it, did I understand like the vastness of it. So it is really an interesting conversation. And we had a conversation with a circus student in London about like it, contemporary, traditional, and then like, is there this like new age of circus
coming up now, post-contemporary?
And like, do you have an idea or an opinion on that? Because I feel like there is a new kind of energy coming, but I don't know what it's called, what it is. I don't know.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting conversation, because it's kind of fresh in my head too, because I'm watching it. Right. And I'm experiencing it. And my background is traditional. And I work with, I live with a lot of traditional circus people in Sarasota and in the area and in America. Right. And I'm really, I'm like, man, it's like, whoa. Okay. So with the newly formed American Circus Alliance, right, I look on a screen and I just see young people, a lot of young people. And I'm doing a lot of studying and finding backgrounds and everything of people, and it's very interesting as well. And it's a different energy for sure, right? And I'm gonna be the guy that's gonna kind of pull the traditional guys along. Hey, come on, it's okay. And I just got my fingers crossed for it that way. Because just like when Cirque du Soleil started, there was this whole thing like, this is not circus. But the good news is, for example, in Sarasota, we have the Circus Ring of Fame at St. Armand Circle, which is a beautiful area. And there's bronze wagon wheels that honorees are given. And, you know, that's a high award. And last year, Guy Liberté was actually won the award. So we're pulling it in. It's happening, you know, it's coming. It just, you can't just make, you can't have a tank and make a left turn, right?
Sure.
And I equate it to a tanker because it's huge. It's huge. The energy is huge. And so we just have to turn a tanker slowly, slowly, slowly. And everything will be fine, you know? So
yes, one degree over a long period of time is quite a different path.
Yeah.
Exactly. But it's a very interesting question. And I'm looking at it. And my journey to... So we worked in Laurent in Montreal, Dahlia and I. It's I don't know if you know it, Laurent. It's a... they have a summer fair. And so Tarzan Sabini, who's another traditional circus guy, used to, and Joe Bauer, they would put the tent up there each summer. And Dolly and I produced a strap act, right? A few years ago after my accident when I gave up my cloud swing. And Guy, I don't know if you know the name Guy Caron.
Sure.
He was the original artistic director for Cirque.
And then also he was involved with the circus school in Montreal early on too.
Absolutely. Right? He was one of the founders for Ecole. Yeah, and the priest, some priest, they started it basically, right? So I got to know Guy very well. And actually I invited Guy to come down to Sarasota and help us put together our strap act. And we were Dolly and I actually were the first pas de deux duo to actually do the strap back swinging in the round. Very much so. The big guy was Dimitri. He was, I think it was in Sultan Banco. I think it was. I can't remember exactly. But he blew everybody away with the strap back, right? So he was like the original guy that came out to these straps and like, wow, wow. So when I had the accident, I said to Dolly, we always wanted to work together, but we never got the chance. So we took the opportunity and we decided to do a strap act, but create a pas de deux. So Guy came down, helped us put it together. And then Jean Leger, who was at one time the choreographer, artistic director, choreographer for the Winnipeg Royal Ballet. So he came down and gave us some pointers and stuff like that. So we put the act together. And like I say, we started in Busch Gardens in Florida and then went up to Laurent. Guy Caron said, hey, I'm putting together a show in Japan, in Takarazuka, which was an amusement park. And that's when I got to meet the originators of Cirque Eloise, Danielle, or the gang.
Is it Finzi Pasca? Is that who started?
Sorry?
Is it Danielle Finzi Pasca? Is that the guy who started? No. He's just one of the directors.
Yeah, he could have been. So there were a lot of Daniels. So
yeah.
Rock was there. His girlfriend, Danielle Sear, was there.
Oh, yeah.
Daniel was there.
Adventure Steer Wheel. Yeah.
Boudreau, the brothers, Damien, Alain. Anyway, we had great fun in Japan. And that was the first year before they went on to do fairgrounds as Cirque Eloise. So that was my first taste of contemporary, if you want, you know, where I was going with this, basically. And I mean,
sorry, not to cut you off, but as a married couple, we love hearing married circus couple stories. So I'm just wondering also if you can quickly recount.
I can tell you a quick one. I'll tell you a quick one. So yeah, we formed this love story on the straps. It was actually called On Wings of Love. We called the act On Wings of Love. But so husband, wife, right? And I'm very on point with music and things. So we used to have these lots of arguments, smiling while working, of course. And it was, this is the classic story. And this one time, we would just spin together, this one point, right? And we came together and we like kiss, and she bit my lip. I swear, if we had microphones on, it would have been a comedy, right? You're wrong. I'm right. You're fast. You're slow. So long story short, we went to Japan. And then we got booked to Stuttgart. And I said, no way, man. We're going to kill each other. And so that's when I kind of said, you know what? This is my opportunity to do something I've always wanted to do. And that was the idea was to start a professional circus school in Sarasota. And so we incorporated in 1997. As the National Circus School in Sarasota, National Circus School of Performing Arts. And so we had the cart before the horse, like so huge it was ridiculous, right? We didn't know anything about school. I mean, we knew about the school, but how to start it and funding and all that stuff, right? And then we said, you know, if we build a circus, we can tour and make money. And then we start the school. So we formed the launching board. It's 1997. We found a used tent in Orlando. That's another story all on its own. A Russian group came out from Russia with this tent, and they put it in Orlando, like competing with Mickey Mouse, you know, and Universal Studios. So it didn't succeed, obviously. And they owed a lot of money to a lot of creditors. Lawyers grabbed it, and it was for sale. We saw it, and we bought it. Like, yay, we got our own tent. And so we started doing shows, 1998. And we put on like the best show ever. People didn't work for top money because they knew what we were starting to do. I mean, we had like great acts. And I forget another Daniel, he did a solo bicycle act from, he was also part of the troupe. Anyway, long story short, if you build it, they will come, right? No, that's the school of hard knocks. So we had like 100 people, maybe 150, 200 people, and the tent seated like 1,600, right? So anyway, long story short, we're very honorable people, and we finished. We owed some people money, and Dolly actually went to work at Busch Gardens again. We used that money to pay everybody off, so nobody was owed any money. We packed up the tent, and we have a performing arts hall here in Sarasota. It's called Van Wezel Performing Arts Hall. They were going under construction, and they asked if they could rent our tent. Oh, man, we thought we died and went to heaven, right? It was like, I thought it was, the area was right on the water. There's palm trees, and it's on the main street. The traffic was ridiculous. So the people driving by saw this tent. It was fantastic. That was the next year, right? And so in the tent, we had a jazz festival. We had ballet. We had B.B. King played in the tent. And eventually in the wintertime, we did our performances, and it was great. It was really great. We did our best, right? Then the next year, it was 98, 99. And then, that was the beginning. But this one winter, it was a very, very cold winter. We had no budget. We had no money. Selling tickets was the budget, right? So you took out advertising. You rented the crane. You got the forklift and everything. Now you have to make money and pay it back, right? And this cold winter, nobody came out. They weren't coming out. We didn't have heaters. Of course, you couldn't afford heaters. And so I made a decision then to say, okay, that's it. We tried. It didn't work. Close it now before we get too much in debt. And there's one guy, this older gentleman, Al Van Tegen. He was one of the ushers, retired, moved to Sarasota. He looked at me and he said, what the hell's wrong with you? And I said, well, Al, we can't do this. We're going to close it. And he said, no, whoa, 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 whoa. He said, what do you owe? I said, we owe $76,000. The creditors, newspaper. And he said, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to loan you the money. I'm going to become your treasurer, and we're going to pay off the debt, and then we're going to go from there. And if he hadn't done that, we would have closed, right? And the very next year, when we did the show, we doubled our box office, and the graph started doing this up, up, up. So our thanks to Al Van Tegen. I always thank him. You know, he doesn't know how many times I say his name. But, it was one of those moments. And the funny thing is, we had a three-year balloon on the tent with the bank. I didn't know the bank was going to be sold, so they called the loan. We didn't have the money, so we had to sell the tent. That was reality, right? So we actually sold the tent and seats and everything to Tito Gaiano. Do you know Tito Gaiano? You know the name?
Flying Trapeze.
Very famous Flying Trapeze act. So we sold it to them. And the next few years, we rented tents from Tarzan Sabini, from Joe Bauer. And then my brother-in-law decided he wanted to buy a tent, and he wanted me to manage the tent. So we rented a tent from him. And after about 3 years, he wanted to get out of it. And we bought the tent from him, and that's the tent we own today. So that's the story of the tent.
Nice.
The tents in America are also an interesting thing because America's so big and touring with a tent, and Josh did his whole thesis when we graduated grad school on touring with tents in America. And tents are so magical and I love them so much. And then I think like watching circus in a tent is far superior than watching it in a theater, even though I like watching it anywhere. But the reality of a tent is a lot of work.
Oh yeah. So my business plan, my business model, I built a business model, strategic plans, touring plans, had the budget thrown up, everything. And so we started, we actually did go down to Fort Myers, and that was my dipping my toe in the water, so to speak. Right. And you don't just get an audience, you build an audience. I mean, that's the way it happens. You build your audience. And so for 3 years, we toured to Fort Myers, which is just an hour and a half away, right? And so the first year we broke even. The second year we like made like $10,000 profit, basically. But we built the audience to about 13,000 already. And then 2008, recession, boom. Took a hit, went into debt, obviously. And they made the decision that said, okay, touring's off the table. Boom, done. And so then we concentrated in Sarasota and built our brand in Sarasota. A much bigger, stronger brand. One of the best things I ever did was collaborate with the Sarasota Ballet. Robert DeWarren was then the CEO and artistic director. And a volunteer, Jan Silverstein, so let me go backtrack a little bit. In 1998, our first performance in Sarasota was actually at the John and Mabel Ringling Museum. We worked in the wagon room, and it was awesome. Our backdrop was a Five Graces wagon, this beautiful red wagon with this gold leaf. And that's another story, going to the director of the Ringling Museum and saying, hey, I would like to perform in a museum. He was like, you what? I said, imagine your people, patrons coming in here. They walk into a museum, which represents the past, and they walk in there and they see people flying in the air and they see the present. And this person in the air comes down, lands on the ground and says, hi, where are you from? And have a conversation with his people. He said, oh, okay, let's, we did it. We tried it. That was our first performance, was in the Ring Museum. We did it for 3 years, actually. And then they went under construction. And that's another story. So, and that took like a 10-year hiatus before we were invited back by the new curator of the theater. And he said, hey, do you guys want to perform at this? And we looked at him and he said, are you kidding? Like, I've got so much to talk about. It's like I can go back, forward, sideways. So we do 8 weeks in the summer at the Ringling Museum. There's a beautiful theater. It's called the Oslo Theater. It's a three-tier theater, seats 257 people. And so for the past 14 years, we've been doing 8 weeks. Actually, it started with 4 weeks, became 5 weeks, became 6 weeks, and then now 8 weeks. Because we sold out every time. It's an affordable ticket for locals and for tourists that come and visit, right? So we do quite a few shows.
So just for a little bit of clarity, the organization is both a school and a performing arts company, right? Correct. Like there's the Sailor Circus component is the school, and the conservatory is the performance group.
Yeah. So originally the National Circus School of Performing Arts, we changed it to Circus Sarasota because we were doing performing. And then in 2011, the Sailor Circus was started off at the Sarasota High School. There was an accident, and the school board, because it belonged to the school board, is on the school board property. The school board, because of budget cuts, and they used liability insurance as an excuse, they said, okay, we're going to get rid of this. The sheriff department has a non-for-profit, 501c3, obviously, and it's called PAL, P-A-L. They are like, they take naughty kids off the streets and stuff like that. So they took over the Sailor Circus. The sheriff actually changed later, and in 2011 we got the phone call to say, hey, we're the sheriff department, you're the circus. Would you like to run the sailor circus? Of course, we said yes, right? So that's how it happened. So then we decided, we're becoming very confused. We have the Circus Sarasota. We now have Sailor Circus. We also do other outreach programs, humor therapy in nursing homes. So let's come up with a brand that's going to be the umbrella of all of it. And that's how we started the Circus Arts Conservatory. Because education, legacy, it's all under this umbrella. So that's basically it in a nutshell.
So again, just jumping back in time, because I didn't want to miss it. You mentioned that you had a cloud swing accident of some kind.
Yes.
Or an ACT accident. I'm wondering if you can speak to that. And before that, almost everybody who we've talked to who has fallen off of a tight wire or wheel of death or something that has really changed their life due to accident, somehow it always seems to push them on a different path they were always strangely destined for.
It does. Yeah, it does. So I equate to do one door closes, another door opens, right? It's always, that's the way I look. The glass is always half full. It's got to be. You keep moving. And when the door doesn't open, you kick it in, right? That's, you got to go. Come on. So unfortunately, so on the Big Apple Circus, the jump that I spoke about and to the rope that was tied up with a piece of string with the bungee, I couldn't set it myself because there was horses before me. And so I used to go up to the cloud swing, used to roll up to the cloud swing. And when I was up there, the stage, the ring crew would move the rope that is pulled up to the stage right, if you will, where I had my stakes in front of the curtain. And they would shackle the bungee and tie the string, right? So last 2 weeks of the season, of my second year, right? I do my act, I slow down, Paul Binder comes out to the ring, he says, and now, ladies and gentlemen, blah, 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 you know, what you're about to see, da, da, da. And I build up my swing, the rope's there. He actually shook the rope, shook it. Everything's normal. I jump. And of course, you jump, feel the string break, right? Look down. And then it was like, okay, I'm on the ground. I've got the rope in my hand, and I'm in bad pain. Like I said, I think my ankles or feet are broken. And then I was laying down, and your brain starts trying to compute this and what happened. Because I got the rope in my hand. I didn't miss the rope. And I looked up, and I saw the cable and the shackle swinging. And I said, shit, they forgot to attach the bungee. So that's what happened. So I came down. Of course, I've locked my legs to land. And of course, I just came down. You can basically like jumping out of a four-story building, right, straight onto your feet. So both my ankles literally exploded. My right ankle, I had two plates and 18 screws. And then my left ankle. That was a good one. My right ankle was so compressed. Both were compound fractures. Eventually, I had to have my right ankle fused, subtalar joint fusion. So after that, I would go to the gym and just work out and work out 3 hours and just work out and work out and work out. Dolly would practice, right? So I would always be there for training. She would work out. And then the story goes, I tell you what, it really is pretty phenomenal because it's weird. It's a closure. You know, people talk about closure. I didn't have any closure. It's different if I fell myself or, you know, I missed the rope. That's my fault, but it wasn't my fault, right? So I didn't have the satisfaction of closure. Long story short, Dolly got offered a contract with Hammett Circus, which is a shrine. They do shrine shows. And I called Jimmy Hammett, the senior. I said, hey, Jimmy, do you want to book my cloud swing act? And he said, I didn't know you're doing your cloud swing. I said, yeah, I've been practicing at the, you know, Sailor Circus. I practice there. He said, damn right. Yeah, I'll book your cloud swing act. So he booked my cloud swing act, which I hadn't been practicing or anything. So I said, okay, Dolly, cloud swing art, go to at the Sailor Circus. We actually trained here and practiced here at the Sailor Circus. And I started practicing, and then I had to do that first jump, right? And man, I tell you, you got your cojones up in your throat, you know? It's always you have to do the one. You do the one, the ice is done. You break the ice and it's done. It's over. You finish. You know, it's good. So I did it. I toured. It was a small tour with them. They actually, it was the anniversary of the fall of the Wallanders, the seventh Imperium in Detroit. Was the anniversary, and they hired the Wallanders to recreate the seventh Imperium in the exact same place where the accident happened. And I was part of that tour, and Dolly was part of that tour. And after that tour, the candle light went out. That was it. I had total closure. I packed up my class ring and I said, that's it. I'm done. I'm cool. Absolutely. So, yeah, it's just like that. That's a, but I had to have closure. It was really a thing. And then it gave me the opportunity to start what I really wanted to do, right? And so that was the beginning. Because if that door didn't close, the Circus Arts Conservatory wouldn't be, right? So that's life.
Oh, my God. Terrifying. But so a very important question. How did you and Dolly meet? I feel like I saw it in one of your bios, but I'd love to hear the story.
Yeah, so I was booked to the Blue Show in Venice. That's where the shows rehearsed and then started. And she was on the Red Unit. And the Red Unit was taking a two-week hiatus. You know, they stopped for 2 weeks. So she saw my act in Venice, right? That was the first time she saw the act. And there's, again, another weird story. I told you I went back to South Africa and we trained and went back to Ringling. It didn't work out for me. We were training at when we came back in late 86, 87. And it just didn't work out with the troupe. And so I decided to leave and bring in a replacement. I actually brought in a replacement for me in the Flying Trapeze Act and stuff. And I went back to Europe. But before I went back to Europe, I went to practice in Sailor Circus. And guess who was also practicing in Sailor Circus? Dolly Jacobs. So that's how we started to get to know each other. That's the short and sweet of it.
I want to jump right back to the present before we wrap up. So obviously COVID hit this year, now almost 9 months ago. So yeah. I'm wondering how's that affected the company? Have you guys found ways to do shows? How has it played out?
So we lucked out with our February show. We managed to finish our run, and that's really our bread and butter, is doing the professional circus shows. We've managed to finish that, and that's when COVID really hit hard, and we had to cancel a show that's called Cirque de Bois, Voices of the Circus. We collaborate with Key Corral, which is the choral group. And so we have like 100 voices, a 42-piece orchestra and circus. And we work together with that. And it's our 10th anniversary or 11th anniversary now. So we had to cancel that. We had to cancel the Sailor Circus Spring Show. And we had to cancel the 8 weeks at the Ringling Museum, the 8-week summer show. So that obviously financially, it gave us a punch in the stomach, obviously. And what we did was, though, we adopted all the CDC guidelines, etc., because we had a summer camp program that we wanted to run. Usually we would have 100 students a day. We dropped it down to 50, 55 students a day. And then we obviously invested in all sanitizations and bleach and all that kind of good stuff. We also bought two foggers to fog the arena. We fogged everything, the offices, the storage spaces. And we actually fog the arena every evening. After everything, we hang all the silks and everything, fog everything, and we continue. And we've just now installed ionizers for the air conditioning units. So we have multiple ways of sanitization of the air, purification. And like I said, we wipe everything down like everybody else does, right? And so we're training right now and we're actually in tech mode right now because we open on December 26th through the 30th with our Sailor Circus Academy Holiday Greetings. That's the show. Our arena seats 1,300, and we're going to perform to the maximum of 500. So there's lots of space for seating and things like that. I'll tell you what, the people are still very, very afraid, and very few people are buying tickets in advance. I think we might see some walk-up. You know, people decide on the spur of the moment to come and see the show, but we're also selling a digital ticket. And hopefully the digital ticket will make up a loss of the people that are too afraid to come out and see a show. So it's really, I mean, it's global, right? It's not just us. It's global. It's everybody. And anybody with a building or a tent are suffering the most, obviously, because outdoors is the thing right now. People want to be outdoors, you know. Of course, we're mandating mask wearing. Everybody's got to wear a mask. That's it. I mean, we're dealing with the reality of it all. It's tough, but I think, you know, if we do all the safety that we're doing, we'll be okay. And 2021, please come around sooner than later.
Yes, we're only like 20 days away from the end of 2020 as we're recording this. It can't come soon enough. How can people get information on the live and the digital tickets?
Our website's the best. It's circusarts.org. That's the best way to get tickets. The phone number's up there. The phone number is 941-355-9807. That's the box office. But like I said, the best is buy your own ticket online and print your own ticket at home. We don't have to touch it.
So I have a question, a philosophy question, I guess, before we go into our last three questions that we ask everyone. But one thing that Josh and I are, well, first, Josh is very, very interested in circus history, and we have as many books as we can fit in our little apartment in Brooklyn about just the circus and circus in America, circus in Europe. I get a new book delivery every day. But one thing that we are trying to do in our own lives and our own circus company is the heart and the energy that existed in traditional circus, of this like family feeling. And since a lot of circuses started as a family circus and then grew, and how do you recreate that or try to embody that spirit in a circus that's new and not, you know, a circus of family members? So I guess you came from, you know, a traditional circus background. You're doing this in the contemporary age. How do you feel like you bring that energy into your shows and your school?
So, again, the show that we produce is a mixture of different energies, right? Okay, different styles. And it's a blend that complements each other. It's simple as that, basically. But again, but it's the quality of the act, because the act has to speak for itself and represent itself in the ring. In the school, right now, I have Miguel Vargas. He's a recent hire, right? So he's traditional circus, fifth generation, but coach for 11 years. So he's picked up a lot, like I picked up too, right? Right now we have Darren Turrell, who's cirque artist, lives in Toronto. His parents have a house here in Longboat Key. He found out about us with Facebook and stuff, called us and said, "Hey, I'm in Toronto. I don't have a place to go or train. Can I come down to you and I'll teach and I'll help coach and do whatever?" He's done here. He's practicing his trap act. He's teaching. And here's one thing I forgot to mention. Last year, we started the first ever circus arts magnet program in Sarasota, in partnership with the Sarasota High School, which was where the Sailor Circus Academy originated from, right? So it's gone full circle. And so we started it a year ago. It's very successful. And our magnet student program, students are learning from Miguel and from Darren. And in January, Antonio Moore is going to be joining us, another cirque artist. And so we're building, so Antonio's black, Miguel's Latino. And so we have a nice diverse group of coaches now that our students are going to benefit from. So that's what we're building. I'm trying to build a diverse platform so we can get all aspects of the circus world, so that our students can grow to whatever that other energy is, right? Because yes, speaking though to the traditional circus families, it's never going to go away. It's smaller, but it's not going away. And that's circus, right? It doesn't go away. And it can, so in Italy, there might have been 300 circuses. Maybe there's 200 circuses. You know, I don't know, but I mean, that's not going away. That's a circus knee is not. I say that it's not going away. Of course, you know, a bomb drops, it's gone. So,
yeah, but they've I'm made saying, it you know, 215 yeah. years so far. They should last a few more.
So no, the tradition will continue, and the other aspects of it will evolve, right, into what it's going to be.
Well, man, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. You're so the real deal, and it's just been like, just it's awesome. We ask all of our guests the same three questions to finish off every interview.
Sure.
The first question is, has somebody given you a piece of advice that's really good or really bad that has stuck with you?
Yeah, my mentor, do it the right way. Literally, just, you know, do it the right way. Don't cut corners. You know, this is that old school of this is the way it's done to a degree, that's very important. And I took that as quality. And so all the acts, when we produce a show in the traditional circus in the past, for example, a lot of producers will be for profit, will book a family that do five acts, right? Because it's called a package deal, right? Because the producer puts money in his pocket because he's for profit. In the 20, going on 24 years that we produce shows, one single act did two acts in a show. And that was David and Danya. They did the Quick Change Magic.
Sure. And they're great.
And right? Amazing act. And her hula hoop act was totally amazing. So that's the only act that we produced in 24 years that did two acts. We just book you for your best, what you can do best. That's what I want. That's all we want. So it's really about quality. So my mentor, George, do it right.
That's awesome. Okay. Second question. For somebody who is a circus student and trying to learn about the form and the history and just the world, is there a book or a movie or a show when we can go back to seeing shows that you would recommend a young person try to check out or experience or read or see?
Well, I would say definitely watch all the old circus movies. Trapeze, Circus World, The Greatest Show on Earth. There's a Danny Kaye circus movie. There's a Charlie Chaplin circus movie. Just soak it all in, right? That's what I did. I soaked it all in, took it all in. The more you look at it, the more you feel it, the more you smell it, right? And then, of course, today there's the contemporary side of it. Take that in as well. My thing about the new world of circus is I think a lot of stuff's overdone, overblown. It's just too much. It's like, there was no book that I could read of how to do a circus, build a circus, right? No, you just use your energy, you use imagination, and all the stuff that you've seen around the world, you take it as a thing of clay and you mold it and you do it. You just do it. And so it's like it's, with education, it's, for me, it's really, I'm old school. So for me to read a book on how to do it is crazy. Show me how to do it, please. Can you demonstrate it for me? Then I can see it. That's how I learn. That's how you learn. You learn on the road. Miguel and I were just talking about it. The kids need to learn how to put up the trapeze net. You know, why do it for them? That's how they learn. That's how they learn to tie a clovis or whatever the case is. You know, reading a book is one thing. It's single dynamic. But somebody showing me, that's how you learn. So that's my thing is, find people who can show you and talk to you, and that's the best way of learning.
That's why we started this podcast, because we were like, we want to learn. And now we have all these people who get to talk to us and we hear amazing stories like yours. So our final question, and going into what you were saying, is who should we have on our podcast?
My wife. you can hear the other side.
Yes, I'd love definitely. That.
Yeah, we are total opposite energies. She's like she's so gifted, right? Like I still like just look, man, whatever she does, it looks good. I have to really work at it. I have to think about it. And she's just like, tra-la, you know. But unfortunately, She had both her hips replaced a couple of years ago. So that basically ended her performing career. So now she coaches at the Sailor Circus Academy. And it's amazing to watch her coach, because she gives her total being and spirit to her students. And the students are in awe because they know who Dolly Jacobs is. And they are actually getting coached by Dolly Jacobs. And so it's like, whoa. And they are so respectful to it. You know, and it's beautiful to watch from the outside. I mean, I give them a few tips and stuff like that. But it's we're in the show, we actually have two students doing rings in the show, swinging rings. And it's a beautiful thing to see. You know, the product being produced and then finalized and actually performing. So yeah, I'll speak to her.
That would be great.
We would love to talk to her. That's awesome.
Send me some dates and times.
Sounds good. And that was our interview with Pedro Reis.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Instagram and Facebook, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Happy Friday. Fri-yay.
Fri-yay. Happy Hanukkah. Happy holidays as they come up. Catch you guys on the next one.
Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.